Support for PrayPublic is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, specializing in VA loans, home valuations, and estate planning. Bill can be reached at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota. The recently adjourned North Dakota legislative session was one for the history books. It took place during a global pandemic, and bills pointed at COVID-19 were prominent. We witnessed the first ever expulsion of a member of the legislature, and Governor Doug Burgum wielded his veto pen. The Prairie Pulse television show recently featured Republican Senator Ray Holmberg and Democratic Representative Josh Boshi in a conversation with host John Harris. Here's that discussion.
Senator Holmberg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
As we get started, we always ask, tell the folks maybe a little bit about yourself and your background.
I was a high school counselor, and before that, I taught government at Central High School in Grand Forks.
In Grand Forks. And what drew you to become a state senator for North Dakota?
It was a fluke in that the federal courts had redistricted Grand Forks, and the entire north side of town had no incumbent senators or representatives. I went to a meeting, and there were four of us there that organized the Republican Party in then District 17, and three of us were elected to the legislature.
Hmm. Well, with that said, of course, you've been there for a while now, and you're the Senate Appropriations Chair. Can you give us some of your just sort of general thoughts on the session this year?
I thought it was, going back to when I taught government and Magruder's textbook, if you're in the majority, you point with pride, and if you're in the minority, you view with alarm. So I guess I would point with pride. I think that the legislature did a pretty good job under trying times with COVID, and with initially a sense that we were going to be broke, and yet ended up quite flush, in part because of over $2 billion of federal money that's already here, and another billion that we haven't dealt with yet. That's coming up later this year.
Is North Dakota in good fiscal and financial situation as we go forward now?
I think it is. I think we had a good year, and our budget numbers are still running ahead, and we have a conservative estimate going forward, but we keep getting better than what our estimates are. I think going forward, we will do well.
Talk a little bit about bonding bills and infrastructure and sort of that legacy fund spending that a lot of people are interested in what's going on. So quite a bit there to talk about.
We used to bond, and then we had about a 12-year gap where we didn't. Last session, we did a little bonding. This time, we did $680 million. But one has to look at what that accomplished. First of all, it finalized the funding for the Fargo diversion, which frees up other money for other projects around the state. We completed, with bonding, the Harris Hall project here at NDSU, which is not just an NDSU building, but it's for agriculture across the state. And we put more money into roads. So it was kind of a change for many in the legislature. But with the interest rates as low as they are, I think it was a wise investment. And again, freeing up other monies. And we have a method of paying those bonds back, which is a painless method, I guess, if you can use that term.
Mm-hmm. How about funding for K-12 and higher education? How did that play out?
Well, the governor asked for a 7.5% reduction in funding for higher education, and that included the university system and also extension and experiment station, which is a separate budget, but all in the same vein. The university system asked for what they called a needs-based budget, what they felt they needed to continue. We had the bill in my appropriations committee. We started out on day one saying we are going to go with the needs-based budget. And at the end of the day, we passed that university budget in the Senate unanimously, which indicates that people really liked what we were doing and what the university system had been doing. You know, there were sideshows and things like that. But at the end of the day, there was a lot of support for both Ag Extension and for the university system.
Mm-hmm. We talked about it before we came on camera. I guess there were a couple of bills or a number of bills that were controversial. One, Governor Burgum vetoed, was the transgender sports bill. Can you talk a little bit about that? And was it even necessary to introduce that bill?
Well, I was one of those that voted no on the bill. And I was not convinced that it was necessary. I think there were many problems with the bill. Within the bill itself, there were contradictions. And I think the governor did the right thing. But it was a painful bill from the standpoint of the strong feelings on both sides. Mm-hmm. So I think at the end of the day, the right thing happened. I think the North Dakota High School Activities Association has a very good policy. Even the proponents of the transgender bill said it was a good policy, but they could change it at any time. And at request for, well, then why don't we just enact what their policy is into law so they can't change it all the time? But that was not acceptable. So what happened happened. The governor vetoed it, and the Senate did not override the veto.
It's my understanding, but wouldn't North Dakota have risked losing events had the bill passed?
Yes, that was testimony that was given. And we heard that particularly from Grand Forks, Fargo a lot, and from Bismarck. And also, those kind of bills sometimes give a state a reputation that is not savory when it comes to encouraging people to come to the state. And I think we've had a good record the last 10 years. We gained 110,000 people in 10 years. We don't want to jeopardize anything.
And the mask mandate bill, of course, did pass despite Governor Burgum's veto. Can you explain what the bill does and what it means going forward?
What the bill does really is just say that state officials, the governor, the health officer, cannot mandate the wearing of masks, but your county health officer, your mayor, your county commission, they can still do it. It was a sense that the local people should make those decisions, because what happens or what's going on in a pandemic, for example, in Fargo is vastly different than in Steele County or in Bowman County. And there should be that opportunity to let the local people weigh in and decide on it.
Okay. Well, higher education and the so-called academic freedom became sort of another hot issue. Can you discuss or explain this bill to us?
Are you talking about the challenge grant bill?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, the unfortunate part of that was those two concepts, the concept of giving money to foundations at a university to help students, has nothing to do with Planned Parenthood. And the merging of those two bills, which was done on the Senate floor, not in any committee after hearings, was, I think, the wrong way to go. I think that if you're going to have a measure like that, it should be a bill introduced on its own and rise or fall based upon the testimony and what the committees find. So I think it was an unfortunate thing, and it became one of the many sideshows that occurred during the legislature. I always say the legislature is like a three-ring circus. You've got the main events, and then you've got the sideshows, and particularly the bloggers love to, whenever there's a shiny object that comes along, they like to start singing Send in the Clowns, and that gets all of the attention of the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain how much money North Dakota is going to get in federal coronavirus funding aid, and how might that be invested?
We've received and appropriated around $2 billion of federal money. We also have another $1 billion in the queue, but we don't know what the guidelines are yet. So we set that money aside. So you can expect the legislature to come back to Bismarck later this year, once we have the guidelines from the federal government, to determine how much flexibility we have with that funding? Does it go to human services? Does it go to highways? Does it go to retirement systems? I mean, there are just a lot of questions. We had no answers, so we just put it off. That's why you find that in our general fund, which is income tax, sales tax, those kind of taxes, the increase from last biennium was 3%. But with federal money and other funds, it was a 21% increase in what we had last time. That's why our budget numbers have jumped so high, because of federal money and then because of the bonding.
Senator Homer, it's always nice to be in the majority party, but in your estimation, is a Republican supermajority a good thing, or is it too much?
We will see the answer to that question this fall when we redistrict, because if you look at where the, and this is going to be generalization, there are only a handful of Democrats west of Interstate 29. So that whole vast area of the state is represented by Republicans. There will be a shift in districts, a dramatic shift, and Republicans are the ones out there that are going to take the brunt of the hit, if you want to call it a hit, that you get moved out of your district, for example. So it's going to be interesting, and that will tell more than number of Democrats there were in Bismarck, because there weren't a lot of them. There were 7 in the Senate and 14 in the House. So that's not a lot. And 120 Republicans. So 120 Republicans will have interesting discussions as we redistrict.
We've got about a minute left. What are your priorities kind of leading up to and heading into the next session in 2 years?
Of course, one of them will be redistricting, which I will be on the committee. And the other is, how are we going to reasonably spend this other $1 billion that has been borrowed from our grandchildren that the federal government gave us to spend? How do we invest that money over the next months when we find out how we can do it? So that's what I would view as a priority going forward.
All right. Well, Senator Holmberg, thank you for your time today.
And thank you for inviting me.
Joining me now is Fargo Democratic State Representative Joshua Boucher. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
You know, before we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background, maybe.
Yeah, well, I have the privilege of representing North Fargo in the State House, where I also serve as the minority leader of the Democratic Caucus. I grew up in Minot, but have called Fargo home for the last 21 years, started here at college and have had done my career ever since. So currently, I have the privilege of also working at Hatch Realty, where I'm a real estate agent when I'm not in meetings with the legislature.
Well, and that's what you're here to talk about today, the recent legislative session that just wrapped up. Can you give us, I guess, some general thoughts about the session?
Yeah, you know, it was a COVID session, so there was a lot of unprecedentedness that we all experienced. So it was quiet in the fact that we didn't, engage a lot with the public in person, but we had the ability to interact with the public virtually and through our hybrid technology. I think the report that came out last week was well over 800,000 people watched the session at various points. So that was a great way to stay connected and to be transparent with the work that we were doing. But as far as our accomplishments, I feel it was a very successful session. We passed some mile marker legislation and made sure that we funded government for what North Dakotans expect. But there was also a lot of challenges. There was a lot of distractions and what I would consider some extreme legislation that I think took up some headlines and took up a lot of our time that, had we not had to tackle those things, we would have been able to do even more great things.
Well, let's get into some of them. And obviously, representing Fargo area, what about the FM diversion project? Any news on it?
Yeah, you know, we're pleased to say that as part of the bonding bill, we were able to include the full state portion of the FM diversion. The way previously it had been set up is that we would be making payments every 2 years to cover the state portion. But by doing it this way through the bonding bill, you know, this is a multi-generational project that will be able to be paid multi-generationally. But it also clears up what we call the Water Resources Trust Fund, which is funded through oil money, and that funds major water projects throughout the state. And the FM diversion was taking up a big chunk of that pie. And so by us moving that onto the bonding bill, that frees up cash so that we can make sure that funding throughout rural North Dakota and other priorities throughout the state, water-related, can be prioritized.
Yeah, with that said, what is North Dakota's fiscal situation coming out of the session? And maybe talk a little bit about that legacy funding spending.
Yeah, you know, we're coming out of this pandemic stronger than we expected. You know, both energy prices as well as our state's economy has been doing a little bit better than we expected. So that has helped with the state's general fund. And I think also allowed us to, again, meet the needs that North Dakotans have as far as general services that the state provides. But a lot of that was supplanted and supported by federal money, which helped us get across the finish line with that. But of course, you know, as you brought up the legacy fund, in 2010, the voters created the fund. First 30% of our oil taxes goes into that fund, and that fund has grown quicker than we expected. So at this point, it's over $7 billion is in that fund, which is generating hundreds of millions of dollars of interest. And so we're excited about, you know, there's a lot of back and forth between the Democratic caucus and the Republican caucus, the House and the Senate, but we finally came to an agreement in starting funding priorities of what we call buckets. So some main themes include making sure that we're paying the balance of our what we owe for that bonding bill, setting aside some money for research dollars, for highway tax funding. But then also there's a big pot of money, several hundred, that would be left over to what we are calling other legislative priorities. So when we come back in 2023, after spending the next year and a half talking to North Dakotans, we're going to be able to come forward with some ideas as far as how else can we invest that money.
Let's talk about some of those bonding and infrastructure components.
Yeah, you know, so for our viewers or listeners who aren't aware, bonding is kind of like taking out a mortgage on your house. So we're taking out a 30-year loan to pay for multi-generational projects. And so the FM diversion is a key component of that, as is the Cirrus diversion program up in the Minot area. Then beyond that, we've put some money towards roads and infrastructure and bridges. We know that we can get some money out the door right now. It's cheaper than what we'll pay in a year because of inflation. We're seeing construction costs continue to go up. Labor costs are going up. So before the federal government maybe passes a big infrastructure bill, North Dakota is putting some money out there so we can get these work crews from around the country to come here and help our bridges and roads. So we're hoping that this investment now through low interest rate environment also saves taxpayer dollars because it's going to benefit property taxpayers as well as folks who are paying through other fees and services.
Well, you mentioned property taxpayers. Was there any discussion about that?
Well, there's always many proposals. And in all honesty, I don't remember which ones passed or which didn't. A lot of the conversation is around making sure that folks can kind of age in their home. So especially in a community that's growing like Fargo, you know, we have special assessments that come on our properties, and that becomes a hindrance for folks who might already have their home paid off, be on a fixed income. So there were a lot of discussions about how do we make sure that we help folks 65 and older or those that are disabled. But I'll have to look at my notes to see what we actually accomplished.
Yeah, let's go to education. How did educational funding come out with K-12 and higher education?
Yeah, so K-12 education, you know, first of all, thanks to our teachers and our educators for the monumental work they've done over the last year and a half. We weren't able to fund increases as high as we would have liked, but we were able to get a 1% and a 1% increase over the next 2 years for K-12 education. And that's through our per pupil payment. So the state pays a rate per kid, regardless of which school district they go to. And what we've also had in there is an earmark that says at least 70% of that has to go towards staff or teacher salaries. So it's a way to at least help support school districts as they go into their contract negotiations. But on top of that, there's a lot of federal resources coming in to K-12 education. People may have heard or will hear of ESSER funding. So school districts are getting a formula-funded payment from the federal government that'll pass through the state. But some school districts will get millions of dollars to help with meeting the needs, whether it's delayed learning, literacy, math literacy. In some cases, school districts will use it to expand or to do new building projects that they've not been able to finance through property taxes so far. So K-12, you know, we wish we could have done more, but it came out fairly strong. As far as higher education, you know, the governor had proposed some significant cuts in our university system funding. But in the end, the legislators, we have spent the last year and a half studying the funding formulas. We went back to our idea, and it's what we're calling a needs-based funding formula. So it's, again, based on students, how many students are graduating and completing courses, and then some of the physical plant needs that different campuses have.
A transgender sports bill was in the news quite a bit. It was vetoed by Governor Burgum, and I guess his veto was sustained. Can you talk about that bill?
When I talked earlier about distractions and bills that were negatively impacting our state, this would be one of those bills. House Bill 1298 was introduced under this idea that boys are saying that they're girls so that they can compete in track or gymnastics and outperform young women. And that's just not the case. And unfortunately, it targets transgender students who we have transgender students in our school districts and throughout our state. And this does nothing to help with their mental well-being, with their physical health and safety in schools. And so it just was a conversation that I think was harmful to those kids, but even more harmful as well to our communities. We heard from the tourism industry and from our chambers of commerce who said there are employers who are saying they won't come here. There are industries, whether it's athletic events or other groups, that are saying, you know, there's other places we can go set up shop. We're not going to do a tournament in North Dakota if you pass legislation like this. So, you know, my message to my colleagues, and I've said this every day to them, is that we need to be here focusing on the issues that are important to North Dakotans to move us forward. These types of bills hold us back and actually limit our opportunities.
Another one, the academic integrity bill. Can you talk about that one a little bit?
Yeah, Senate Bill 2030, which was actually started out as a strong bill for the Challenge Grant program through the university system. And what that is the state saying, we're going to put $11.5 million up. Universities, you go raise a dollar or $2 to get one of those dollars. It's a very successful program. You know, we're just hearing recently about the success of NDSU and their capital campaign program. UND has had capital campaign program success. Valley City State's under a capital campaign. So it's a way that the state is leveraging our resources to go get more money from supporters of the universities. What happened was Senator Myrdal, out of northern part of the state, attached an amendment that said that universities would not be able to work with institutions that may refer people to abortion care. And what's unfortunate about that is it was really targeting a professor at North Dakota State University and the research she's doing in helping educate kids on healthy conversations around sexual health and reproductive health and whatnot. And so it became, again, another distraction that hurts our university system because we have faculty who say, you know, regardless of what someone feels about abortion or Planned Parenthood, it is a slippery slope for the state to get involved in saying what we can teach and what we can research or not. And so it's certainly concerning. And as of, you know, the filming of this, we don't know what the governor is going to do as far as a veto or not. But, you know, I've been supportive of asking him to at least veto out that language that restricts academic research.
Well, okay. And Governor Burgum did veto the mask mandate bill, but it was overridden. So what does that mean going forward?
Yeah, so the final version of the bill that the Senate amended on the floor limits to just the governor and the state health officer. So it did open up. The original conversation also said that local government couldn't have a mask mandate. The amendment on the Senate floor removed that. So it did allow for local control in those types of conversations. And so since the governor's veto wasn't sustained or it was overridden, it is now law that the governor or the state health officer cannot issue a statewide mask mandate going forward.
Going forward, what are your top priorities?
Well, going forward, you know, we're in a strong fiscal position. Families throughout North Dakota have gotten resources from the federal government. We want to get people back to their jobs. So I want to spend the next year and a half working with legislators and the executive branch for us to figure out how do we make sure this isn't just a shot in the arm, that we're going to, you know, have a leg in productivity or opportunities for these families and for North Dakota. How do we sustain it? What kind of policies do we have to look at to make sure that North Dakota families are doing well and that are able to work themselves up and out of poverty and out of low-income situations?
Hmm. Well, Josh, we thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Always a privilege to be a part of Prairie Public.
Prairie Pulse television show host John Harris in a conversation with Senator Ray Holmberg and Representative Josh Boshi. We should also note that Governor Burgum late last week vetoed the penalty provision in the legislation regarding challenge grants at universities with relationships to organizations involved with abortion. Coming up on Main Street, we'll go behind the scenes of an upcoming improvisational theater performance. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Bismarck is hosting the annual Williston Basin Petroleum Conference this week, but there was some uncertainty around it.
We were concerned, you know, coming right off of the legislative session and allowing the emergency order to expire. What would attendance be like here?
North Dakota Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helm says the attendance so far has been very good. He says 2,400 people registered.
That's a great number, and that's going to grow during the conference. So we are excited to have those kind of numbers of people who want to get together and network and want to break the ice and get back to pre-pandemic kind of activity.
Helm says he senses more optimism in the industry.
Inventories are back into the normal range. And unless we see a massive resurgence of COVID somewhere in the world. Demand is nearing what it was pre-pandemic.
Helm says the one area that hasn't yet recovered is air travel.
Air travel still hasn't fully recovered, but actually gasoline and diesel demand are above pre-pandemic levels. So we're still lagging about 25% to 30% on jet fuel. We think that's going to come back before the end of the year. But again, that depends a lot on what happens in other parts of the world.
The conference runs through Thursday. A suspect identified as 42-year-old James Mayerhofer has been arrested for DUI and felony fleeing involving an incident last night on the property of Joseph Larson at 1212 49th Avenue north of Hector International Airport in Fargo. Mayerhofer fled authorities, who responded to a disturbance at the residence but crashed his vehicle. He was taken to the hospital for treatment of minor injuries, arrested, and taken to jail. Here's Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner.
During the investigation, deputies learned that sometime during the incident, shots were fired by Larson. At this time, the investigation is still ongoing. Larson was not arrested at the time, and we are currently reviewing all information that we received at the scene, and we'll eventually turn that information over to the state's attorney for further review of the case.
And North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer says he doesn't know what to expect when President Biden delivers his budget to Congress. Appearing on Fox Business, Cramer said he thinks there could be some agreement on an infrastructure package.
I hope that it's not going to be more of the same, doubling down on more borrowing, more spending on social programs, when we could be investing in an infrastructure package that has as its primary purpose the profitability of the private sector, the movement of goods and services, the global competitiveness of the United States, creating all of these jobs to build it out and to maintain it, while at the same time having an infrastructure that facilitates a growing economy.
Cramer said he would also like to see an increase in defense spending, especially in the area of cybersecurity. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And joining me now, a couple of performers who've got a big show coming up this weekend at Theater B in Moorhead. Tim Larson and Jacob Harchi are Theater B ensemble members. And their show is Tim and Jacob Are Friends, Scriptless. That's the important word. Improvisational theater is about to be sprung on us. Tim, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Jacob, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Jacob and I shared a stage in Hamlet not so long ago, although it seems like a very long time ago, considering what we've all been through. Well, pardon my pun, Tim, but how did the show come to be?
Yeah. Well, Jacob and I have been doing improv together for about 20-some years now. And as ensemble members at B, I think Theater B, you know, has a lot of shows they do that kind of fit within a certain type, right? Traditional plays, and we're always looking for opportunity to try new things, and having a love for improv, it was only a matter of time, I think, before we could pitch the group, hey, we want to do this show. And it seemed like a great time, kind of coming out of the pandemic. I think there's a need for shows that are a little bit easier to do. And what's easier than improv, I guess, at least in terms of production.
Set, right. Props.
Right.
Could be a little stressful for the improvisers, however. Jacob, how would you describe improvisational theater to somebody who's never experienced it?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I would describe it as trusting. They have to just go in and be willing to kind of play the game with you and realize that it's all coming right now from your imagination. I guess I would describe improv to someone that doesn't know what it is as it's a relationship with the audience where they provide an idea, but the performer creates a scene.
Yeah.
And
I've heard jazz music a lot, right? It's something that's kind of free-flowing and you're not quite sure where it's going to end up. But hopefully when it's done, it makes something beautiful.
There might be a theme in there that you get back to.
Right.
In the meantime, you're going to have your moment, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you've worked together before in improv, and that helps, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. So, you know, 20 years ago, Jacob and I went to Fargo South High School here in Fargo, and we both at that time, I think Whose Line Is It Anyway? Just started airing on television.
That was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. And so as as high schoolers, we were like, wait, what is this? And it totally captured our attention. And a bunch of us at the school started to just meet after school in the theater kind of on our own time. And that eventually developed into a actual club, the Don Quixote's Improvisicles, which is still there at South today, 22 years
it's
later.
So cool that that legacy is still there.
Yeah. So we were doing that, and that just kind of has stuck with us ever since. Jacob and I have been part of the Fargo Moorhead Linebenders, and then we both, you know, done improv in other ways and other venues over time. But, you know, I would say my relationship with Jacob is probably, when I look back now, one of the older improv relationships that I have. So it worked out that the two of us could kind of get together and want to do a show like this where it's a little more challenging. Just one other person on stage with you the whole time.
Now, anybody who's been through formal actor training knows that improvisation is a piece of that that's commonly used to sort of help people free themselves, use their imagination, get creative in front of an audience, that kind of thing. What you're talking about here, Jacob, is long-form improvisation. Now, what I just described would be short-form improvisation.
Sure. Right.
You're not doing an hour show in an acting class. So describe the difference.
I would say that a lot of times long-form, short-form, short-form improv to me I think is really looking for the laugh.
Okay.
You're trying to find that game where it's like, oh, this person wants to leave. I'm not going to let them leave. Now that's the game. That's the conflict, and you're working around this short, maybe 10 to 5-minute scene looking for the laugh. Find a good button and then end it. With long-form, I think the only modus operandi is to just really live in the character, feel the character's emotions, and let the scene build around the relationship between your scene partner. It doesn't have to be funny. It doesn't have to be dramatic. It could be maybe boring. But I think that's how life works. I think that's how a song or even a script works. It's like there's tension and release. There has to be hills and valleys. Otherwise, if you're always at an 8 laughing, even if you laugh at a 10 – it just doesn't feel as good.
Right.
But if you create some tension and you bring us down a little bit into that negative zone, and then we can come up and laugh, even if it's a 6, I think that's really more rewarding. So I think long-form improv is focusing more on just genuine scene work and not necessarily going for a laugh.
Yeah.
Jacob Harchie and Tim Larson are Theater B ensemble members. They'll be the stars in the upcoming show at Theater B this Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock. Tim and Jacob are friends, scriptless. You can see it online, so you can go to theaterb.org and, you know, go to the box office and figure out how much you want to contribute to the performance. Or you can actually go to the theater, although there is a very limited capacity at Theater B because, of course, we have these pandemic protocols in effect. Tim, how do you rehearse improv, and what is the role of director Tucker Lucas in helping you through this process?
Great question. So rehearsing improv for Jacob and I is really probably just getting together and allowing each other freedom to kind of just explore ideas. You know, with improv, it's a lot about getting a suggestion from an audience and using that as inspiration to create these scenes. And so a lot of times it's understanding, trying to learn how to trust each other more, get an understanding of where Jacob might be taking something and trying to lean into that. You know, I think the rule for improv, the most common one everybody knows is, you know, yes and, always agree, right? And so getting more trust with each other, understanding that I have no idea what Jacob is doing right now, but I'm going to go with it. And so we do a lot of that. We've because of the pandemic, we've rehearsed in my basement at my house, right? Just the two of us. And my wife is in the other room saying, why are they yelling at each other? You know, but it's a lot of that. And then in terms of Tucker, Tucker is there to kind of be one, you know, just from a technical standpoint, Theater B trying to be able to share this to people who maybe aren't comfortable leaving the house for a show like this yet, and making sure technically we're prepared to stream it out live. But also he's there to kind of make sure that we have what we need as performers to put the best show on possible. So if there's props or anything that we need, he's been doing an awesome job to really help us out there.
Yeah.
So Jacob, does Tucker then throw out ideas like the audience would and have you riff on them? Or?
Yeah, basically. Like we kind of have a format where we build a rapport with the audience. And then based on that conversation, we're listening, we're mining maybe keywords or emotions. And yeah, so Tucker is really great to have someone in the room to kind of bounce your ideas off of to say, okay, we were trying this. It didn't feel great for me, but I was in it. So I'm living it. Like, how was it from your perspective? And then there's a little bit of a conversation about, you know, I think just like maybe where to put your energy, you know, and how to try to craft a scene. And I think that's what Tucker does for us, is kind of says like, oh, maybe you went a little too far there off the rails. And, you know, he has a good way of keeping the reins in on me.
Yeah.
Of course, the worst part of being a stand-up comedian is the heckler, although right. Some comedians feed off it. Maybe it helps their comedy, you know, because they've got something ready for that rude audience member. But the audience does have an important role in improvisation. They're part of the act in a sense. So
totally. Yeah.
what do you hope for, Tim, from an improv audience?
I mean, the best thing is that they're interactive and that their suggestions are, I guess as an improviser, not ordinary. I love the unusual. You know, we could do an improv show right now at a couple different bars throughout North Dakota, and there's a good chance a couple suggestions would probably be the same, right? You might get the president's name thrown out. You might get, you know,
local
COVID
scandal,
or something,
COVID,
right?
Yep.
But the stuff that – and so we can almost expect some of those things sometimes. But when we get suggestions that are out of the ordinary, that's like a challenge for us and exciting for us, I think, to play with that stuff.
Now, really good improvisers are so good, frankly, that sometimes you think, I think they're kind of scripted. Mm-hmm. And you two have been together. You've been doing this for 20 years, you say. So you probably know some of the characters or the sort of the directions that you've gone before that have been, you know, pretty good veins to work. Give us a sense of the give and take part, which is so essential to improv, about – you know, kind of the wink and the nod that keeps the show going.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I think you bring up an extreme point. Because I think, you know, like an instrument, here we are. And, you know, a saxophone can only make saxophone sounds. So me as a performer, you know, I'm 5'7". You know, like right. I will only be me. And so the voices and the characters that come from me, I guess you might find them in like an old treasure chest that I have kept there, my go-tos. But I think the wink and the nod, it comes to that trust that you were talking about, where you have to let go and you can't go to your comfort zone. I can't go to my old pirate that I love to do. Like, no, you know, I have to live right now for the audience because they're trusting us. They're trusting us not to lie to them. And I don't want to. I think, you know, they came to see something that's never been done, will never be done before, and that's what I want to give them. And I can't walk off stage feeling like I have artistic integrity if I've just gone and pulled out some old bit that I know crushes. And that to me is not improv. If they came to a comedy show, I would say, hey, this is a comedy show. Then I'm not really responsible. But if it's an improv show, I think it's really important to me.
It's about organically coming to the character, right? You may have that pirate that works really well, but just throwing it out because he knows a pirate voice is going to land doesn't work. But if organically the scene gets to a place where, oh, this is a perfect opportunity for a pirate to walk in, right? Then Jacob's going to pull it.
Yeah,
exactly. Then we're going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, a scripted play has scenes that have sort of a curve to them. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. The play in general does too. So how do you know when the beat or the scene has ended, Tim?
Well, we definitely take cues off of the audience sometimes to find those moments. But I think that's probably where long form is a little bit different than short form improv sometimes, where there's not always necessarily an ending, a defined strong ending, but there are beats or just buttons to things, right? It's how life is. You know, life, there's not always an ending to something or a feeling that a person has, but there are chapters that conclude. And I think that's probably what an audience might experience at this particular show is that, you know, we're showing vignettes, little moments, and hopefully they come together to tell a larger story. But is it going to all wrap up to perfect resolution? We do our best.
Yeah, exactly. It's improv.
Well, Jacob, will you have little costume elements or props that the audience might want to have you employ?
That's a great question. When we first were rehearsing, we were working on our structure. You know, like what makes this our long-form improv show instead of some of your Heralds and some of your more well-known formats. And one thing that I was like is maybe we should just have a big table of random stuff on it. And that way – if the character is called to it, or maybe we could start a scene with a teddy bear.
Right.
And then you kind of have this monologue and then the other character could come in and now you've built this something together.
Yeah.
But I think we decided that we were just going to strip it all away. Super simple set. We've got two chairs and two 2-foot by 2-foot boxes.
Right. Yeah, and I think this is a bit of an experiment for Jacob and I to do this this particular show together. And you know, our hope would be that over time we can continue to do a two-person show like this. And with the audience, it'll probably evolve, right? There could be props down the road. There could be a totally way of us getting suggestions from the audience. And so we're kind of learning as we go. And even the format of the show is improvised a little bit over time.
Well, I think we've seen this actually in other forms of entertainment. And I'm thinking specifically right now, for example, of the movie Nomadland, which Frances McDormand captured an Oscar for that. That movie had real people playing real people themselves.
Yeah.
And there were large chunks of that movie that were literally improvised.
Right.
That is, the director rolled the camera and Frances and whoever was on the in the frame with her, interacted in a way that was not scripted. It was perhaps described. This is our objective in the scene, but the words are yours and the direction is largely yours too.
Yeah.
So sometimes improv, as we've mentioned before, can be serious.
Right. Yeah, and that's a good example too, right, in that movie because there's these moments of just real life that's playing out. And yet when you're watching the movie, there's a couple moments that I think the audience laughs at something a character says or something that happens. And there's a rule in comedy or in improv that we say a lot, which is truth in comedy. It's if Jacob and I go up on stage and we're trying to make the jokes,
it'll never land.
The audience senses that.
Yeah.
But if the humor comes organically through, you know, just strong characters who have strong points of view, things like that, then the comedy really comes out. So that's what we're hoping to attain.
There's a reality to this too that I think sometimes gets forgotten. And we are all human beings living our lives in the moment. We are improvising.
Oh, yeah.
Every day, everything that comes out of our mouths is, you know, something I'm saying because I want to say this. And I'm looking at you to see how you react to it,
totally,
which is what improvisers do.
Yeah.
So there is something kind of deep and human about this exercise as well. So how do you prepare the audience for it? Because they, again, are so important to this. Do you have a sort of a set routine that gets them ready to, you know, be creative?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think you're right with the whole audience is a big portion of most improv shows. With this particular one, I think because it is long form, we're going to be going to the audience much less.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of right away, we're going to kind of talk to them about what they're about to see, let them know that, yeah, there might be some scenes that are low energy, maybe somber, maybe even sad. But we're trying to take your ideas and bring us all the way to a conclusion. So there might be highs and lows. How would I prepare the audience? I would just say, like, trust us. We're going to be stewards of your imagination and your time. And
yeah, I think, you know, traditionally, I guess for somebody who's listening who's not that familiar with improv, right, short form sometimes relies on a lot more games that are played within some sort of a structure, whereas long form is we're going to get a couple suggestions from the audience and then we might not go back to them for you know, 45 minutes.
Okay.
Right? And so I think the what we're hoping is that the audience connects with the connections we're making based off of our early conversations with them, and how, you know, hopefully it's shown on stage as to where our inspiration is coming from. I think that's probably it. So.
Jacob, you said that, you know, you got this pirate character that occasionally flies out of there.
Sure.
But that gets to the other thing, that you're talking about this long-form improvisation. Will you be maintaining a character for the extent of the evening, the performance? Or will you be changing age, gender, nationality, all, you know, all of these other things?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the beauty of this format is if we started the show – and we got a suggestion that we needed a protagonist. We needed a single note that went through the whole piece. Then I guess we would do it. We would just realize whether Tim's playing it or I'm playing Greg or whatever, Greg needs to be there. And so maybe they would be through every scene. But because it's loose, we basically have a loose format where we take the suggestions, we do a scene, just whatever. It could be whatever you want. Then we do a completely non-connected scene. Two new characters, a different situation,
yeah.
Try a different scene, not connected at all. And now we've created these three kind of pockets in this world. And now it's like, okay, well, was anything interesting there? Or could maybe a character from scene A meet with character C? Or like in scene C, right. Would that be interesting? So yeah, we'll be changing gender. We'll be changing characters. We'll be changing everything.
Yeah. But again, it's all organic. So if it seems like, you know, we start out the show and we have these two characters on stage and only one of them is interesting, you know, that's the one that might show up in the next scene. We kind of have to be in touch with what, you know, what's working with the audience, what yeah. is working for us, what characters we find interesting. The last thing we want to do is, you know, explore something that's boring, right?
So. Yeah, and the audience doesn't want you to either.
Right, exactly.
So
yeah.
That's sort of the complication there. So is this a 45-minute show, an hour show, or does it end when, you know, the sun rises?
It could, yeah. No, I think we try to shoot for about the 45-minute to probably an hour show, right, mm-hmm. is what the experience is. Again, we could go over a little bit. We could go if it's all organic, and I keep using that word because when it feels like we've come to a moment where things should wrap and there's a bow on it, hopefully that's where we end.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Tim Larson and Jacob Harchi are Theater B Ensemble members. They are the two stars of the upcoming Tim and Jacob Are Friends Scriptless, which will take place at Theater B Friday and Saturday. The show is at 8 o'clock. There will be an audience present, but again, go online and check out the box office to see whether there are available seats in the theater. Online, you can watch it anywhere and as many people as possible. Again, it's a pay-as-you-go show that is you can choose between $5 and $50 a ticket. And, of course, Theater B would love your contributions. Tim and Jacob, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Yeah.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Danielle Allen was a college professor in Chicago teaching night classes for disadvantaged students. One of the things she used to teach was the Declaration of Independence. She picked it, she said, in part because it was short.
Several years, over and over again, teaching the Declaration, close reading, slow reading, as you said. I wanted to share that experience of just sort of the power punch the Declaration can land.
Dr. Allen is African American, and so she's well aware that admiration for the Declaration of Independence can be a little complicated.
How do we appreciate the good that was achieved at the founding while also being clear-eyed and honest about all the wrongs that were also part of the founding?
Hear her tonight at 8 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 11th. May is National Historic Preservation Month. Today, we continue to look at Grand Forks schools on the National Register of Historic Places. Between 1949 and 1965, Grand Forks added a number of new schools. These schools drew on the skills of local architects and marked the progression of the budding population. Theodore Wells and Myron Denbrook designed some of these schools and some later additions. Wells was born in Grand Forks in 1889. He attended the University of North Dakota and did a great deal of architectural work around the area. Denbrook was born in Ohio in 1922 and was younger than Wells by more than three decades. Denbrook graduated from the University of Washington and began his career in Washington, but according to his son, he sent out a bunch of letters requesting to be a partner somewhere. He planned to go wherever he heard from first. That response came from Theodore Wells in Grand Forks. In 1948, they created the Wells and Denbrook Partnership. West Elementary School was designed by Wells and built in 1949. Typical of mid-century design, it has a flat roof and long banks of windows. It is also located near University Park, allowing the school to take advantage of green space, landscaping, and playgrounds, typical of the mid-century school design. Wells and Denbrook also provided mid-century additions to Lewis and Clark Elementary, which had been built in 1953 by local architect Samuel Teal DeRemer, and in an interesting turn of events, they built Wilder Elementary School, preserving a gymnasium added by DeRemer in 1955. Denbrook designed that new 1965 school so it would match the style of the gymnasium. Although Wilder Elementary sustained damage in the 1997 flood, the exterior remained largely the same. It's also the only mid-century school in Grand Forks without a separate kitchen and lunchroom. Instead, the gymnasium is used for this purpose. West and Denbrook designed many buildings in the region from the 1920s to the 1990s, and it's been said that Denbrook designed many of the buildings on the UND campus. Listen for more stories of preservation in North Dakota as Dakota Datebook continues to acknowledge National Historic Preservation Month. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
discover how human lifespans have doubled in less than a century.
It's one of the greatest achievements in human history.
Transforming the kind of lives we might live.
Join Stephen Johnson and David Olashoka as they reveal the forgotten heroes of global health, whose innovations led to breakthroughs in vaccines, medicines, cleanliness, and other tools we use in the fight for Extra Life, a short history of living longer.
Watch the new series, Extra Life, tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org, and then after the broadcast or live stream, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, we'll share an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast featuring Dr. Tom Frieden. He's the president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives. That's an initiative that aims to save 100 million lives globally. And Courtney Schaaf, an organizer with North Dakota United, has been selected to be a Bush Fellow. She'll share her plans for the award with our Ashley Thornburg. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.